This is a reading of the autobiography of Rudolf Steiner entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. Chapter 47. Now, when I speak about these two, quote, unknown yet known, unquote, I am aware that most people will consider what I have to say as wild fantasy. It has to do with the way I was privileged to become close with those two human souls in the realm they found themselves in after passing through the gate of death. It is everyone's undeniable right to view any statements about this sphere to be of no interest, but to describe them as mere fantasy is a different matter. I must emphasize to those who do so that I have always searched exact studies, such as mathematics or analytical mechanics, for the sources of the soul condition that allows one to assert spiritual matters. Consequently, when I state such things as follows, no one can accuse me of making careless statements with no responsibility to knowledge. The forces of spiritual sight I carried in my soul at that time facilitated a close relationship with those two souls after their earthly death. They were not like the other dead. Usually, life after death is initially related closely to earthly life. Then, only slowly and gradually, does it begin to relate to life experiences in the purely spiritual sphere of existence, prior to the next earthly life. Both of these unknown yet known souls had been versed thoroughly in the materialistic ideas of their time. Both had processed as concepts natural scientific thinking itself. The second, with whom I became connected in Weimar, was even well acquainted with Billroth and similar scientific thinkers. On the other hand, they had both remained aloof from a spiritual worldview during their earthly lives. No doubt both would have rejected any view of this kind that might have confronted them, because it would have appeared to them, according to conventional thought habits, that the facts demand natural scientific thinking. But only in their world of ideas were they bound to modern materialism. They did not lead materialistic lives, which should have resulted from the materialism of their thinking and prevailed all around them. They were odd characters in the eyes of the world. They lived on a more primitive level than was usual or demanded by their means. Thus they did not carry into the spiritual world a materialism that affected the life of will, but only the consequences of materialistic thinking in their individuality. Naturally, all this took place mostly in the subconsciousness of those two souls. Now I could see that after death, the fruit of materialistic thinking does not itself alienate one from the divine spiritual world. Such alienation occurs only when materialism enters the sphere of the will. The souls of both men, the one I was close to in Vienna, as well as the one I came to know spiritually in Weimar, were magnificently shining spiritual figures after death. Their souls were filled with images of spiritual beings who were connected with the foundation of the world. They had been familiar with ideas that in their previous earthly life helped them to think through material phenomena more exactly. Had such ideas remained alien to them, they would not have been able to develop such a discriminating relationship to the world after death. The significance of scientific thinking was revealed to me directly from the spiritual world through those two souls who entered my destiny. I saw that this way of thinking as such does not necessarily lead away from a spiritual worldview. This happened in relation to those two individuals during their earthly life, because they found no opportunity to elevate scientific thinking to the level where spiritual experience begins. After death, they accomplished this perfectly. I saw that scientific thinking, even during earthly life, can be elevated to this level as long as one gathers enough inner courage and strength. And through experiencing such a significant event in the spiritual world, I saw that humanity must develop the ability to think scientifically. In earlier times, thinking was constituted so that it could unite the human soul with the spirit of the suprasensory realm. If self-knowledge is practiced at all, which is the foundation of all knowledge, it could lead people to awareness of themselves as a copy or even a member of a divine spiritual world. But it could never bring people to experience themselves as independent, self-contained, spiritual beings. Consequently, progress had to develop our capacity to apprehend a world of ideas, not kindled by the spirit itself, but those stimulated by matter, a realm of ideas that is in fact spiritual but not derived from spirit. There is no way that we can kindle within ourselves that world of ideas while we live in the spiritual world between death and a new birth. This must be done during earthly life, because only on earth do we encounter material existence. Through those two souls, I was able to experience what a person gains for life as a whole, including for the spiritual life after death, by interweaving with scientific thinking. But I saw others whose will during earthly life had taken hold of the consequences of purely scientific thinking. They had alienated themselves from the world of spirit, and in the totality of life they lived less in their humanity through scientific thinking than would have been the case without it. Those two souls had seemed odd in the eyes of the world, because they did not want to lose their humanity during earthly life. They assimilated scientific thinking completely, because they wanted to reach a stage of human spiritual development that is otherwise unattainable. Had I met those souls as physical beings in earthly life, I might not have been able to gain such understanding through them. I needed the great subtlety of spiritual sight to perceive them within the spiritual world, where their inner natures and much more could be revealed to me through them. The subtlety of spiritual sight that is needed can be lost very easily while experiences of the physical world conceal, or at least impair, what may otherwise be experienced in a purely spiritual way. Because of the unique way both souls entered my life, I had to see that this was something determined by destiny for my path of knowledge. Yet there was nothing of a mediumistic quality in my relationship to souls in the spiritual world. A connection to the spiritual world had no value for me unless it was based on direct spiritual perception, which I publicly discussed later in my anthroposophic writings. Furthermore, all the members of both the family in Vienna and the family in Weimar were far too sound to have mediumistic relationships with the dead. Whenever I encountered it, I was always interested even in the kind of searching expressed in Spiritism. Spiritism today is an erroneous path to the spirit, one practiced by souls looking for spirit in a phenomenal way, even through experiments, because they have lost all feeling for any true, genuine spiritual way. One can best appraise Spiritism and its erroneous orientation and goals when one's interest is objective, with no desire to use it as a means of research. The paths of my own spiritual investigations were always well removed from any form of Spiritism. It was possible, particularly in Weimar, to have interesting discussions with Spiritists, because for a while artists were very interested in finding a relationship with spirit in that way. Through my interaction with the two souls, Oinicke was the name of the one who had lived in Weimar, I received inner strength for my title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom. What I tried to present in that book is this. First, the result of my philosophy of thinking during the 1880s. Second, the result of my direct insight into the spiritual world in general. Third, to find new strength through my encounter with the spiritual experiences of those two souls. In them I perceive the human ascent in evolution that results from the scientific worldview. But they also revealed the fear of noble souls living into the will aspect of that worldview. Those souls trembled at the ethical consequences of that worldview. In title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, I looked for the power that leads from the realm of the ethically neutral scientific idea into the world of moral impulses. I also tried to demonstrate how, because human beings live in ideas that no longer flow from spirit, but are stimulated in relation to material being, we can recognize ourselves as self-contained beings of spirit, and thus develop intuition for morality out of our own being. This means that morality shines from within the self-contained individual, who has become free as individual ethical impulses, just as ideas do in relation to the phenomenal world. those two souls had not advanced to such moral intuition. Thus they shrank unconsciously from life. They had seen life only in terms of natural scientific ideas that had yet to be expanded beyond the physical. At that time I spoke of moral fantasy, imagination, as the source of morality within the human individual. I certainly did not intend to indicate that this source was not fully real, just the opposite. I wanted to characterize in fantasy, imagination, the power in all domains that enables the true spirit world to break through into individual human beings. Before the spiritual can in fact be experienced, the powers of spiritual cognition must be developed, imagination, inspiration, and intuition. But the first ray of revealed spirit within the human being, consciousness of oneself as an individual, occurs through the power of fantasy. This power is not at all fantastic, but becomes an image of spiritual reality. This method can be observed particularly in Goethe. End of chapter 47. Chapter 48. I lived with the family left behind by the Weimar unknown yet known during most of the time I lived in that city. I had part of the house to myself. Anna Oineka, who quickly became a good friend, selflessly provided for all my needs. She attached great significance to the fact that I stood by her side in the heavy responsibility of bringing up her children. With Oineka's death, she became a widow with four daughters and a son. I saw the children only when an opportunity was arranged, which happened often since I was considered a member of the family. However, I had my meals, except breakfast and supper, elsewhere. I found a wonderful connection with that family. I did not feel alone, but rather happy. Some of the younger visitors who came from Berlin to the Goethe Society meetings became somewhat attached to me. Once, when they wanted to be, quote, cozy among themselves, unquote, they came to see me at Frau Oineke's house, and I have every reason to believe that they, too, felt very much at home there. Otto Erich Hartleben also liked to come to this house when he was in Weimar. We assembled, titled The Goethe Breviary, that he published there in a few days. Of my larger works I wrote, titled Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom, and titled Friedrich Nietzsche, Fighter for Freedom, there. I think, too, that also many of my Weimar friends enjoyed visiting me for an hour or so at the Oineke family home. I am thinking particularly of Dr. August Fresenius, with whom I was connected in a true loving friendship. After a certain point, he became a permanent associate at the archives. Previously, he had been editor of the title German Literary Journal. His work there was universally considered to be a model of its kind. Much weighed heavily upon my heart against philology, especially as it was developed by adherents of Scherer. August Fresenius, however, won me over again and again because of the philologist he was. He never hid the fact that he wanted to be a philologist and a true one. But to him philology was truly a love of words that vitalized the whole human being. To him the word was human revelation that mirrors the laws of the whole cosmos. One who truly wishes to comprehend the mysteries of the word needs to understand all the mysteries of existence. A philologist, therefore, has to develop a universal knowledge. When applied appropriately, proper methods of philology may, beginning with the very basic, powerfully illuminate, broad, significant aspects of life. Excuse me, let me read that again. When applied appropriately, proper methods of philology may, beginning with the very basic, powerfully illuminate broad, significant aspects of life. Fresenius demonstrated this in an example that was very interesting to me. We discussed this example a great deal before he published a short but concentrated article about it in the Goethe Yearbook. Until this discovery by Fresenius, everyone concerned with interpreting Goethe's Faust had misunderstood a remark Goethe made 5 days before his death to Wilhelm von Humboldt. His words were, quote, Es sind über 60 Jahre, dass die Konzeption des Faust bei mir jugendlich von vornherein klar die weitere Reihenfolge hingegen weniger ausführlich vorlag. End quote. Prentice's translation more than 60 years ago in my youth, the idea of Faust from the beginning was clear to me, though less so in the details. End parenthesis. Commentators had interpreted from the beginning to mean that from the start Goethe had an idea or plan of the whole drama of Faust, into which he more or less incorporated the details later on. Even my dear teacher and friend Carl Julius Schroer was of this opinion. It must be realized that if this were true, then Faust would be a work that Goethe conceived and mainly outlined during his youth. One must admit that it could have been possible for someone with Goethe's soul disposition to work from a general idea and elaborate it for 60 years, while the main idea remained essentially unaltered all the while. The fact that this was not the case was proved beyond doubt through a discovery made by Fresenius. He showed that Goethe never used the expression "from the beginning" in the way his commentators had implied. He would, for instance, say that he had read a book from the beginning, but not the end. He used the expression "from the beginning" in a spatial sense only. This proved that all the commentators on Faust had made a mistake, and that Goethe had not spoken of a plan of Faust that existed from the beginning, but only that the first part was clear to him as a young man, and that only here and there had he developed some of the further details. Thus the correct use of philology shed significant light on Goethe's whole psychology. When this was published in the title Goethe Yearbook, the only thing that amazed me was that whereas this should have had far-reaching implications for understanding Goethe's spirit, it really had very little effect upon those who should have been most interested. It was not just philological matters, however, that were discussed with August Fresenius. Because we spent a great deal of time together, we had lengthy discussions about everything topical, everything interesting that was happening in Weimar and elsewhere. Our discussions on many subjects became agitated at times, but they always ended in perfect harmony, because we were convinced of the soberness of each other's conviction. It is, therefore, all the more painful when I recall that my friendship with August Fresenius also suffered a rift because of the misunderstanding that arose from my relationship with the Nietzsche archives and Frau Förster Nietzsche. My friends could not understand what had happened, and I could tell them nothing that would explain matters satisfactorily for them, because, in fact, nothing had happened. Everything was based on misunderstood illusions established in the Nietzsche archives. What I was able to say about it in an article I wrote later for the title Review of Literature. What I was able to say about it is in an article I wrote later for the title Review of Literature. I deeply regretted these misunderstandings, for my friendship with August Fresenius was true and strong. Another friendship I have often remembered is that with Franz Ferdinand Heitmüller. He too joined the archives as collaborator, but after Wahler, von der Hellen, and myself. Heitmüller was sensitive and artistic. He really decided everything based on artistic feelings. There was nothing intellectual at all in his makeup. Because of him, something artistic entered the whole tone of how one spoke in the archives. He had published subtle novels. He was certainly not a bad philologist, and his work for the archives was no worse than that of the others. But he always maintained a kind of inner opposition to what was done in the archives, especially in relation to how the work as a whole was conceived. For a time he made us very aware that in the past Weimar had been a place that was culturally alive, a center for distinguished productions, and that now we were content merely to confirm versions of manuscripts once produced, trusting every word, and at most adding interpretations. Heitmüller wrote anonymously about this in the form of a novel titled Vineta Submerged, which was published in S. Fischer's title New German Review. Much effort, then, went into guessing who had turned the once culturally flourishing Weimar into a submerged city. Heitmüller lived in Weimar with his mother, a very congenial lady. She became friends with Frau Anna Oinecke and enjoyed visiting her. Thus I had often the pleasure of seeing both of the Heitmüllers at the house where I lived. I remember another friend whom I knew from the early days of my Weimar period. We were very close friends until I left, indeed even afterward, since I occasionally returned to Weimar on visits. This was the painter Joseph Rolitschek. He was a German from Bohemia, who had come to Weimar for the sake of the art school. He was a thoroughly loving person, and it was a pleasure to open one's heart to him in conversation. Rolitschek was sentimental and at the same time slightly cynical. He was pessimistic. On the other hand, he tended to value life so little that it seemed to him not even worth being pessimistic about. Yet when he was there, we had to discuss a great deal about the unfairness of life. He could go on forever about the injustice that the world had done to poor Schiller, unlike Goethe, who was so favored by destiny. Although my daily social contact with such individuals meant a constant lively exchange of ideas and opinions, while I was in Weimar I was not inclined to speak directly about my experience of the spiritual world, even to those with whom I was otherwise intimate. I maintained the viewpoint that one must realize that the correct entry to the spiritual world first leads to consciously experiencing pure ideas. I asserted in every possible way that just as one consciously experiences color, tones, the quality of warmth, and so on, it is possible to consciously experience pure ideas that have life of their own, completely uninfluenced by all external perception. Real living spirit exists in those ideas. And I spoke of the fact that all the rest of a person's spiritual experiences must sprout in consciousness from this experience of ideas. The fact that I sought spiritual experience first in experiencing ideas led to the misunderstanding I mentioned. Even my intimate friends considered me a rationalist or an intellectualist, for they could not see the living reality in ideas. Max Kreislip, a younger man who often came to Weimar, was the one then who most energetically comprehended the living reality of the world of ideas. This man was searching for knowledge of spirit, and at the beginning of my stay in Weimar I saw him rather often. He had completed his training to join the Protestant clergy, and was just taking his doctoral examinations. He was also preparing to go to Japan as a kind of missionary, which he did soon after. This man comprehended, with enthusiasm, I can say, that one lives in the spirit while living in pure ideas, and he realized that what exists before us as matter is merely appearance, illusion, that the whole external world, in order to be known, must first be revealed by the world of pure ideas. And he saw that these ideas reveal that the reality within everything physical is spirit. I was deeply satisfied to find a person with such a clear and thorough understanding of the spirit being. He understood the presence of spirit in the archetypal idea. But there, the spirit lives, of course, in such a way that the perceiver does not yet see the living, creative, spiritual individualities emerging from the general sea of ideal spiritual existence. I could not yet speak to Kreislip about spirit individualities. That would be asking too much of his beautiful idealism. But one could speak to him about spirit as a true being. He had familiarized himself thoroughly with everything I had written so far, and at the beginning of the 1890s, it was my impression that Max Kreislip had a gift for penetrating the spiritual world by means of the living spirit in the idea, a way I can only consider the most suitable of all. This is not the occasion to discuss the fact that later he did not keep to this path, but chose a somewhat different direction. The end of chapter 48. Chapter 49. I became acquainted with the proprietor of a bookstore through the liberal politician I mentioned. At the time I was in Weimar, that business had seen better days. It was then still in the hands of the father of the young man I came to know as the owner. The important thing to me was that this business also published a newspaper with articles that surveyed contemporary culture and reviewed publications in the areas of literature, science, and art. The newspaper was also in decline, and its circulation had dwindled. Nevertheless, it provided me with an opportunity to write about many things that were either in or coming into my spiritual horizon. The many articles and book reviews I wrote were read by only a few, but it was pleasant to have a paper at my service that printed what I wanted to publish. This stimulus bore fruit later when I became editor of the title Review of Literature, and had to share intensively in feeling and thinking in contemporary culture. So Weimar was indeed a place that I often had reason to recall later in life. The restricted life I was compelled to lead in Vienna had widened, and I experienced much in terms of culture and human nature, the effects of which showed later. Most important of all, however, were the human relationships. When, in later years, I looked back at my life in Weimar, a particular family, of whom I was especially fond, always appears to my inner vision. I became acquainted with Neufer, an actor, when he was still engaged at the theatre in Weimar. What I valued, first and foremost, was his earnest, conscientious approach to his profession. In his judgment of stage art, he allowed nothing amateurish to pass. This was especially satisfying, since people are generally unaware that dramatic art must conform to definite technical rules, just like music, for instance. Neufer married the sister of pianist and composer Bernard Stabenhagen. I was introduced into his household, which meant that one was received warmly also in the home of Frau Neufer's parents and Bernard Stabenhagen. Frau Neufer is a woman who always radiated an atmosphere of culture into her whole environment. Her sentiments, rooted in the depths of the soul, wonderfully illuminated the natural, informal discussions in this house, and the way she expressed herself was both thoughtful and graceful. Whenever I visited, I had the feeling that Frau Neufer strives in an exceptional way for truth in every area of life. Many instances showed me that they appreciated me. I will give one example. On a Christmas Eve, Herr Neufer called on me, and since I was out, left a message that I must come to his house without fail to share Christmas gifts. This was not easy, because in Weimar I always had to participate in several such festivities, but I made it possible. Thus, next to the gifts for the children, I found a beautifully wrapped special Christmas gift for me, the value of which can be appreciated only through its story. One day I was brought to a studio of a certain sculptor, who wanted me to see his work. I saw a little there that interested me, but my attention was drawn to a bust lying forgotten in a corner. It was a bust of Hegel. This studio, which was part of a house that belonged to an elderly, well-respected lady in Weimar, contained all sorts of sculptural work. Sculptors always rented the room for just a short time, and the artists left behind what they did not want to take with them. Also, lying unnoticed were items that went back a very long time, like that bust of Hegel. My interest in this bust always led me to refer to it here or there in conversation, and I spoke of it once at Neufer's, and I probably hinted gently to the effect that I would have liked to have it. The following Christmas Eve I received the bust as a present from Neufer. The following day I was invited to lunch, and Neufer told how he had procured it. He first went to the lady who owned the studio. He told her that someone had seen the bust lying in the studio, and that it would mean very much to him to obtain it. The lady replied that such things had been lying around in her house since the old days, but she did not know whether a Hegel was among them, but she was quite willing to show Neufer around to see for himself. A thorough search left no remote corner forgotten, but there was no Hegel bust anywhere. Neufer was disappointed. The thought of pleasing me with the bust had given him great satisfaction. He was at the door with the lady when the maid joined them. She heard Neufer say, "A pity we did not find the Hegel bust." "Hegel?" said the maid. "Could that be the head with the broken nose lying under my bed in the servants' quarters?" The last stage of the expedition immediately took place. Neufer was, in fact, able to obtain the bust, and there was just enough time to replace the missing tip of the nose before Christmas. Thus I came to have a bust of Hegel, one of the few things that have accompanied me to many places. I always liked to look to that Hegel bust by Wichmann, 1826, whenever I immersed myself in Hegel's ideas, and indeed this happened quite often. The features of that countenance, the human expression of the purest thinking, build a very effective companion through life. This is how it was with the Neufers. Nothing was too much trouble when they wanted to please someone with something that had a special relationship to them. As their children were born, Frau Neufer proved to be an ideal mother. She educated them not so much through what she did, but through what she was, through her being. I had the joy of being allowed to be godfather to one of the sons. Every visit to this house was a source of inner satisfaction to me. I was able to pay such visits even after I had left Weimar, because I occasionally returned to attend lectures. Unfortunately, this had not happened for a long time now, and so I was unable to see the Neufers during the years when a painful stroke of destiny broke in upon them. This family is one of those most severely tested by the World War. Frau Neufer's father, the elder Stavenhagen, was a charming person. Previously, he had been engaged in a practical occupation, but had retired. He now was completely absorbed in his library collection, and it was a pleasure to see the way he was absorbed in this. The affable old gentleman had become neither self-satisfied nor proud of his learning. Rather, there was in his every word a sincere quest for an expression of knowledge. The conditions in Weimar, then, were still such that they attracted souls who felt dissatisfied elsewhere. This was true not only of those who settled there permanently, but also those who returned again and again for visits. One could sense that for many a visit to Weimar was different than visits to other places. I sensed this particularly in the Danish poet Rudolf Schmidt. He initially came to Weimar for the production of his play titled The Transformed King, and it was during that visit that I first met him. He usually appeared later on occasions that drew visitors to Weimar. This fine figure of a man with wavy locks was often among those visitors. Something about the way one, quote-unquote, is in Weimar attracted his soul. He was a person of intelligent character, and was an adherent of the philosopher Rasmus Nielsen. Through Nielsen, who followed Hegel, Rudolf Schmidt had acquired a wonderful understanding of German idealistic philosophy, and Rudolf Schmidt's judgments were clearly imprinted equally toward the positive and toward the negative. Thus, when he spoke of Georg Brandes, who was bitingly sarcastic and totally annihilating, Thus, when he spoke of Georg Brandes, he was bitingly sarcastic and totally annihilating. He had an artistic way of revealing a whole broad realm of feelings that flowed with antipathy. Those revelations could not impress me except for an artistic one. I had read much of Georg Brandes, and I was particularly interested in his ingenious descriptions, from a broad area of observation and knowledge, of the spiritual streams of the European peoples. But what Rudolf Schmidt brought was subjectively honest, and because of the poet's character, truly captivating. I eventually came to hold him very dear in the depths of my heart, and happily looked forward to his visits to Weimar. It was interesting to hear him speak of his northern homeland, and to see the significance of the capacities that he had developed, precisely out of the essential source of the northern feelings. And it was equally interesting to discuss Goethe, Schiller, or Byron with him. What he had to say about them and what Brandes had to say was very different. Brandes judged everything from an international, personal, cosmopolitan perspective, whereas Schmidt always spoke as a Dane. Nevertheless, this was precisely the reason he was in many ways more interesting than Georg Brandes on many subjects. The end of chapter 49. Chapter 50. Toward the end of my stay in Weimar, I became a close friend of Conrad Ansorge and his brother-in-law, von Crompton. Ansorge later became known as a brilliant artist. Here, however, I am concerned only with the significance of his delightful friendship and my impression of him at the end of the 1890s. The wives of Ansorge and von Crompton were sisters. Because of circumstances, we always met either at the von Crompton home or at a hotel. Russischer Hof. Ansorge was artistic and very energetic. He was a pianist and a composer. During our acquaintance in Weimar, he set poems by Nietzsche and Demel to music. It was always festive when the friends who gradually joined the Ansorge Crompton group came to hear a new composition. Paul Böhler, a Weimar editor, also belonged to this circle. He edited the newspaper titled Deutschland, which was more independent than the official paper titled Weimarischen Zeitung. Several of my other Weimar friends also attended this circle, for example Fresenius, Heitmüller, and Fritz Kögel, as well as others. And Otto Erich Hartleben would turn up whenever he happened to be in Weimar. Conrad Ansorge was originally a follower of Liszt. Indeed, it is true that he viewed himself as one of Liszt's students, who artistically adhered most faithfully to the master. but Ansorge in particular, beautifully presented to one's soul what continued to live on from Liszt. All Ansorge's music sprang from a source of a completely original, individual human quality. The humanity of it may have been inspired by Liszt, but its originality was his music's charm. I relate these things as I experienced them then. I am not concerned here with my later views about them or how I regard them today. Through Liszt, Ansorge had a connection with Weimar stemming from an earlier period. At the time I am speaking of, he had become inwardly free of that connection, and this was the unique quality of the Ansorge-Crompton circle. Its relationship to Weimar was completely different from that of most of the other individuals I have described so far as my closer friends. Those other friends had the kind of relationship to Weimar that I described earlier. This group, on the other hand, worked to go beyond Weimar with its interests. Thus, as my work in Weimar was coming to an end, and I had to think of leaving the Goethe city, I became friendly with people who did not feel that life in Weimar was especially significant. In a certain sense, with these friends, one lived one's way out of Weimar. Ansorge experienced Weimar as a prison in terms of his artistic development, and as a result moved to Berlin about the same time I did. Paul Bühler, though editor of the most widely read paper in Weimar, did not write in the contemporary spirit of Weimar. Indeed, from a broader perspective, he often had very harsh criticism of that spirit. Moreover, it was he who would raise his voice to correct whatever he had been inspired by opportunism or narrow-mindedness. This caused him to lose his position at the time he frequented the group I am describing. Von Crompton was the most amiable person imaginable. The group spent the most delightful hours in his home. Frau von Crompton was the center there, a profound and graceful person, like sunshine to those privileged to be around her. The whole group existed under the sign of Nietzsche, so to speak. First, there was Nietzsche's philosophy of life. This was treated as a subject of immense interest. Second, it was devoted to a soul disposition that revealed itself in Nietzsche as a kind of representation of the flower of the true and free humanity. In both aspects, von Crompton in particular was typical of the Nietzschean of the 1890s. My own relationship to Nietzsche had not changed while I was part of that circle. But because I was the one they queried when questions arose about Nietzsche, the others projected their own adherence to Nietzsche into my relationship with him. Nevertheless, it must be said that those of this circle understood Nietzsche's convictions and tried to live up to what his ideals implied in a more sensible way than did many. Those in whom the ideas of the superior human and title beyond good and evil did not always produce the most desirable flowers. That group was significant for me because of the electrifying energy that was alive in it. On the other hand, everything I felt it was possible to introduce there met with the most accommodating understanding. I indeed look back with pleasure to these evenings, to Ansorge's brilliant music, the shared interest in Nietzsche, and the lively discussions on serious matters of life. It greatly enriched the latter part of my stay in Weimar. Because the arts were genuinely and seriously cultivated in this group, and because they sought a worldview focused on what is truly human, no one took offense at the criticism of contemporary Weimar. In any case, the tone of such criticism was not the same as what I previously experienced in the olden group. There was a great deal of irony. There, a great deal of irony prevailed. Weimar as a whole was considered, quote, human, all too human, unquote, just as one would have viewed other places one was in. On the other hand, in the Ansorge-Crompton group, I would say that more earnest feelings were always foremost. What will happen as German culture develops while a place like Weimar fulfills so little of its destined mission? I wrote titled Goethe's Worldview against the background of my social interaction with that circle, and that concluded my work in Weimar. Recently I had to prepare that book for a new edition, and I sensed in the way I had formulated it in those days in Weimar an echo of the inner form of those friendly gatherings of the circle described. The style of the book is less impersonal than it might have been without that group's repeated words, enthusiastic, energetic, and full of conviction, concerning the nature of the human personality. This is my only book about which I can say this. I can say that all of them are personally experienced in the truest sense of the word, but not in the same way as in writing that book, when I experienced so strongly the being of the personalities around me. This applies, however, only to the general style of the book. I presented Goethe's worldview as revealed in relation to nature, as I had also presented it in my earlier writings on Goethe during the 1880s. My views were broadened only in regard to individual details. They were deepened or confirmed by the manuscripts I first saw in the Goethe archives. In all that I worked on in relation to Goethe, it was always my goal to present the content and direction of his overall perspective to the world. I wanted to show how the breadth and spiritual perception of Goethe's research and thinking have led to individual discoveries in specific realms of nature. I was not concerned with pointing out those detailed discoveries for their own sake. Rather, I wanted to demonstrate that they were derived from a view of nature in accord with spirit. To characterize Goethe's spiritual view of nature as a part of what he gave the world, I wrote an exposition on that aspect of his thinking and research. And I worked toward the same goal as I arranged his manuscripts in both of the editions with which I helped, Kirchner's titled German National Literature and the Weimar Sophia edition. I never considered it my task to present Goethe's achievements in terms of his color theories or as a botanist, zoologist, and geologist, as they are usually considered by a scientific tribunal. I did not consider such an approach appropriate in arranging those manuscripts for the two editions. Consequently, the portion of Goethe's writings that I prepared for the Weimar edition simply documents Goethe's worldview as revealed by his nature research. It was my goal to show how his worldview illuminates the areas of botany, geology, and so on. For example, it has been suggested that if I had arranged the manuscripts on geology and mineralogy differently, the contents would show Goethe's relation to geology. It should be clear, however, that I could never have adopted the approach recommended by my critics. One needs only to read what I said about the arrangement of Goethe's writings on these subjects in my introduction to the volumes I edited for Kirchner's titled German National Literature. This was known in Weimar when the task of editing was entrusted to me. Before I was considered for this task in Weimar, my views were clearly established in what was published in the Kirchner edition. The work was entrusted to me in full knowledge of these facts. I do not at all deny that experts may consider some details in the Weimar edition erroneous. They are free to correct those. But it should not be said that the form of that edition has anything to do with my level of ability rather than the result of my fundamental principles. In particular, such criticisms should not come from those who admit an inability to understand what I presented in relation to Goethe. If it is a matter of occasional technical mistakes, I could show my critics much worse mistakes in the essays I wrote as a student in the upper classes at Realschule. I have made it very clear in this account of my life that even during childhood I lived in the spirit world, which to me was self-evident, and that I had to struggle hard to gain any knowledge of the external world. This caused me to be somewhat of a late bloomer in every area of such knowledge. This is revealed in some of the details of my writings on Goethe. End of chapter 50 and the end of this section of the reading.